Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, a show where we catch you up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the table today are Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Happy Monday.
Hey, Anna.
Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Hey.
Good morning.
And Morgan Trow, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Hey.
Hey, good morning.
We begin this hour with a tale of two ballot initiatives. Ohioans won't be voting to raise the minimum wage this November. The group gathering signatures didn't collect enough by last week's deadline. Morgan, this was kind of a crazy couple of hours on Wednesday. Can you walk us through what happened?
Sure. So the deadline was going to be 11:59 p.m. on the date, and we hadn't heard nothing from minimum wage. I know that, you know, it was very difficult to get a hold of them beforehand. I hadn't heard from them for like a month beforehand. And everybody was sort of up in the air wondering what was going to happen. There was all these road closures because if you're around Columbus, you know Red, White, and Boom, which is a really huge firework display. And it closed all the roads by the Secretary of State's office. So we were all waiting to see if they were going to get in. And then around 5 p.m., they announced that they were not going to be ready. They said that they didn't get enough signatures because of racism in rural counties.
That's a heck of a claim.
That is a heck of a claim. Yeah. They hadn't provided any other insight from that, but they said that. And then a little while later, they went back on it. And they were like, well, we might want to check with our attorneys. We're not entirely sure. And then right after that, they said, just kidding. We're actually not going to have them. And we're going to work towards 2025.
Andrew, you know, I think that claim a lot of people latched onto, particularly people on the right, saying you couldn't get the signatures because you were met with essentially intimidation in rural Ohio.
So I will say that that is an actual thing that ballot issue campaigns talk about. If you imagine sending people who live in the city, particularly there are a lot of minorities working on this, but that's not unusual for these types of jobs where you're going around and collecting signatures. If you're to walk up somebody's 200-foot driveway in, you know, a far-flung area, that it can be kind of intimidating. Like, who knows what actually happens to people? But ultimately, this is the kind of thing that you have to do to get on the ballot. You have to get signatures from 44 of the 88 counties in Ohio, and so. I don't know enough about exactly what happened in this situation, but I will say generally that dealing with the reality of collecting signatures in smaller parts of the state is just kind of something that you have to navigate when you do this kind of thing. So it shouldn't have taken them by surprise that could be awkward.
Yeah. You have to get 413 valid signatures from registered voters.
Well, 413,000.
Yes, 413,000, yes. That 413 would be an easy bar. You could clear that, right? So you have to get 413,000, which means you need quite a bit more because inevitably some of these are going to be incorrect, Laura. But I don't think, did one fair wage, I don't think they used paid petition gatherers.
I don't think they did either. So I kind of had followed this, and these campaigns have to file disclosure forms with the state that kind of disclose whether if somebody's working for the campaign that gets paid, and they filed a lot of those, and I just kind of assumed that meant that they were, but I guess they weren't. So I almost assumed this is going to happen. It really caught me by surprise about a month ago, and it became clear they're kind of losing steam.
The campaign was largely driven by out-of-state organizations. I've heard a lot of criticism that they just were disorganized from the get-go. And, you know, you think about minimum wage, tying it to inflation, raising it to 15, equalizing tipped workers with everybody else. That is a pretty popular proposition. And actually, back in 2006, when the last time Ohio voters voted on tying the minimum wage to inflation and increasing it, it passed handily. And so this is an issue that, you know, you'd think would be a no-brainer to put on the ballot. But I think their disorganization really hurt them. And I think that the fact that it's not going to be on the ballot in 2024 will hurt Sherrod Brown, who is, you know, in a tight reelection campaign. And he's the kind of guy who's been, you know, talking about workers' rights and the dignity of work for his entire career.
Secretary of State Frank LaRose called the whole debacle on Wednesday a, quote, duplicitous, disorganized goat rodeo of a campaign. That is a heck of a quote from Frank LaRose.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it was very disorganized, and they didn't pull the plug until 8:20 in the middle, as 450,000 people went downtown for a fireworks show.
It was a lot of we have it, we don't have it.
Right, and then also, you know, their entire communications team was like went dark on all of the reporters who were covering this issue. All of us had a hard time getting hold of them over the last several months, and so it was really kind of a mystery of what was going on. The only time I kind of got a glimpse of what was happening is when I was out and about in Columbus, and you'd see the petition gatherers, like during Pride Parade or during, I guess they were
one
also,
got me outside of my grocery store, tried to get me to sign.
They were outside the Kroger in the brewery district the Tuesday before the deadline on Wednesday.
Yeah, ooh. And you don't do that unless you're, you know, it's like cramming for the test the night before finals kind of vibes. So they clearly were having a hard time getting the signatures they needed.
So, Morgan, what does the campaign do now? Are all those signatures just tossed out or?
No. So they're not tossed out. So it really depends. So in Ohio, you're allowed to save signatures. However, there's something written in the language of this amendment that says it would start in January of 25, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. So that means that are these signatures going to be valid? Because the language that they signed on would be in the past. So that puts everything up in the air. I don't know if they would say they are considered valid and they are able to be used and they can keep those. I mean, they will probably need a lot more. We don't know how many that they have.
That's true. We just know that they didn't have 44 of 88 counties. We don't know if they cleared the 413,000.
They said they did, but of course don't know if they would be found valid after they were reviewed.
Yeah, like about a month before the deadline, I was told that they had in excess of 460,000. Again, the validity rate really kind of varies, and you need almost twice as many to make sure that you're gonna make the ballot.
And I think the other thing with that is the longer that you have signatures, the more likelihood that they go bad.
That's true. People move, change locations, potentially leave the state. It gets trickier.
Right. So it'll hurt their validity rate this year-long delay. I think they're planning on turning them in the fall. They said in a statement they'll turn them in the fall and then try to campaign, you know, start campaigning for it well in advance.
So let's move on to that other constitutional amendment that we looks like we will be voting on come November, redistricting. A group called Citizens Not Politicians turned in their signatures last week to put the issue before voters. Here's former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor at a rally celebrating the milestone.
This constitutional amendment will restore power to Ohio citizens and take away from the self-serving politicians and their lobbyist friends and big money donors. It will require fair maps and an open and transparent process.
The former Chief Justice is also a Republican who voted with the three Democrats on Ohio's Supreme Court to reject the maps drawn by Republicans over and over again.
Seven times my colleagues on the Ohio Supreme Court and I issued bipartisan rulings finding that the politician-drawn maps were unconstitutional. Seven times the politicians thumbed their nose at the citizens and trampled on the rule of law and imposed gerrymandered maps on our voters. Well, ladies and gentlemen, those days are over.
Andrew, Citizens Not Politicians turned in more than 730,000 signatures, so well above that threshold. It was actually more than the folks who put the Reproductive Rights Amendment on the ballot last November. So, safe to say they're going to make it?
Yeah, we won't know for sure until they do, but one of the features of this campaign is they're very sophisticated. They're clearly well-funded. They have professional signature-gathering campaigns working on these. They have
O'Connor helped write it.
Yeah, they have like technological tools that allow them to pre-screen the signatures for validity before they turn them in. And so the fact that they turned them in on Monday before the Wednesday deadline and didn't spend Tuesday, for example, frantically gathering signatures at the Kroger suggests that they feel pretty good about where they are. Their own numbers have them clearing the 44 county threshold. Actually, they have them in 60 counties. Basically, that means that they have to collect a minimum amount from 44 counties. It's kind of set off of the turnout for the 2022 governor's election. And so we don't know until this review process happens, but kind of between, you know, if nothing else, the clear precedent that the abortion rights measure last year provides, they should be just fine.
So, Morgan, when do you think we'll hear from the Secretary of State about the signatures?
Well, they have a deadline of, 30 days?
No, I think it's like 10 days after they turn them in.
So it should be.
Well, there's a grace period, though. So if they mess up. So basically, so we'll hear in whatever, a week or two, and then they'll have, if they don't make it, which you can argue
would be surprising,
likely that would be, they have 10 days to make up those signatures.
Yeah, they call it a cure period. Mm. So yeah, I can't remember if I think the Secretary of State's office sends them out to the county boards of elections, and all the workers there go through all these signatures, which must be really fun. and then if they don't make it, 10 days to go collect more. But I think based on the number, their sophisticated tools, that it's likely they'll make it. And, you know, then it'll be come down to funding and running a campaign to convince voters. And the redistricting reform measures in 2015 and 2018, you know, passed by strong margins. Now, whether or not this is, if it passes, will it actually take politics out of an inherently political process? You know, who knows? But there's some really huge stakes to how this happens and how it plays out.
So if their signatures are valid, and we're just going to assume for this conversation that they will be, the next step will be getting their ballot language finalized, what will actually appear before voters in November. And as we saw with the Reproductive Rights Amendment, what gets onto the ballot gets pretty political.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a challenge for, I think, each side to sort of condense this issue into a smaller portion, but also, you know, when you do have politicians who could, I guess, be impacted negatively by not having a supermajority anymore, who are able to control or to edit what this language looks like, I mean, that's always going to be a concern for the public.
So we'll see what happens, but just kind of something to think about with the ballot writing part of this is that last year, the abortion rights constitutional amendment campaign wanted the ballot board, which decides what the language looks like, chaired by Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who would lose his role in redistricting if this thing passes. They wanted the full language to appear on the ballot. And LaRose at that time said that, you know, he argued that it was misleading. And so it would be really a good public service to phrase it the way that he and, as it turns out, the Right to Life groups felt would be advantageous to the campaign to defeat it, which didn't work. But so in this case, this amendment's like 20 pages. Are they going to try to have it be a 20-page ballot measure and say that they really, Ohioans
probably
need to understand
not.
How complicated this is and fully be informed about what the implications are for what they're voting on? So it'll be interesting to see the push and pull and how it might depend, how it might switch from last year when sort of like the political winds were blowing differently.
There's also no formal opposition to redistricting yet, but I suspect that there will be one soon. There'll be a pretty well-funded campaign. Senate President Matt Huffman, the architect of those maps that got sent to the Ohio Supreme Court, he's already come out swinging against this amendment.
Yeah, we'll see what materializes from that direction. I mean, we saw last year with the issue one in August that people might remember that would have made all constitutional amendments harder to pass, including the abortion one that ended up passing in November. Arguably, redistricting was sort of on the line then, and sort of the Republican interest when they tried to pass that, you know, they're also thinking about, you know, this minimum wage thing that didn't go. They'd struggled to raise money last year, and so the question is this year when you're, you know, Republicans from the perspective that they're going to look at it, are they going to potentially risk a few of the handful of competitive seats in the country that Republicans currently hold? Is that going to be enough to bring in money from kind of, you know, national donors or whatever? So we don't know what that...
They might want to spend their Ohio dollars on Bernie Moreno.
Well, yeah, that's a big thing. I mean, even like the presidential race, you know, Donald Trump is just sucking up all of the money from, you know, that normally would go into other Republican campaigns and candidates. So that's a big question about whether they'll be able to mount enough money to what we expect is going to be well-funded, yes, on the redistricting measure campaign.
And while we're talking about elections, we know that Republicans and Democrats will have a presidential candidate on Ohio's ballot this November. We're not going to talk about who they might be just yet. But the Libertarian Party of Ohio might have a candidate as well. They've filed a petition for minor party status. Andrew, this isn't the first time they filed or the first time they've been on the ballot. Why do they have to keep re-petitioning to put their candidates' names?
It's rules that Republican lawmakers passed in Ohio about 10 years ago. At that time, I don't know how the Libertarians feel about this, but the Democrats were interested in having a Libertarian candidate on the ballot sort of as a spoiler to suck away votes from John Kasich was running in 2014. I had to take a step back for a second. And that's kind of how the major parties they've used the minor parties as sort of spoilers and kind of as they sort of play things for the, for their own purposes. But essentially they have to meet a higher bar than major parties do. They have to collect a certain number of signatures from around the state and have to recertify their status over and over again. And so we don't know yet whether they'll have somebody on the ballot, but they've taken the first step to apply to allow them to have a presidential candidate this year.
Yeah, the only way that they can stay year after year is get at least 3% in this presidential election or the gubernatorial election in 2026. If not, they'll have to do it all over again.
Do it all over again. There are logistical advantages to being a recognized party. The party...
you get a primary.
Well, and also the party affiliation appears after the candidates' names. There's fewer signatures that candidates have to get in order to get on the ballot. I think in 2014 they made it harder for minority parties.
And while we're on the subject of third and minority parties, Jill Stein plans to submit her signature this week to be on our ballot as an independent candidate for president. But I don't think we've heard from Robert F. Kennedy's campaign yet, right?
I don't know. I know that, Ohio really isn't a swing state anymore. So it seems that the focus has been more in battleground states such as Michigan. It was really big when he got on the ballot there.
But the deadline for that is not for a while. So we'll just sort of see what actually comes up. I think this is just me overhearing stuff as I'm walking down the sidewalk. So very definitive reporting. But I think I've overheard RFK signature gatherers out there. But we don't officially know that or anything like that.
The deadline to submit signatures for the ballot is August 7th, so we'll be talking about it when that deadline passes. Coming up, why you might be guilty until proven innocent if you're charged under Ohio's new cell phone law. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Still with us are Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Andrew Tobias, statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com, and Morgan Trow, statehouse reporter for News 5 Cleveland. If police ticket you for texting while driving, you're going to have to prove that you weren't. Basically, you're going to be guilty of Ohio's new cell phone law until you provide evidence to the contrary. Andrew, that sounds like the opposite of how our legal system works. So what's up with the affirmative defense?
Yeah, so they wrote the law this way before the new tougher texter while driving law took effect. Essentially, you could get cited for texting while driving or otherwise being distracted. But it was a secondary offense where they also had to say you did something else, like make a lane change or speed or something like that. So now they can cite you only for texting while driving, but there are exceptions in the law that, for instance, rideshare companies, I'm sure lobbied so that Uber drivers could you know, hit
adjust
their phones
the navigation
and accept things and, you know, that kind of stuff while they're driving around. So a guy from Licking County named James Havens, after he was cited for this, tried to say that, well, they didn't prove that I did this. And but the appellate court essentially upheld that the state doesn't have to prove it. And the
argument, you have to prove you didn't.
Yes, exactly. And the argument is that the law doesn't allow for law enforcement to search your phone without your permission to investigate whether or not you were, you know, texting your friend about the game or whatever versus operating your GPS app. So,
or changing a song. You are allowed to do single gesture acts, like change a song or a podcast.
Right. So the court reasoned that it's then sort of up to the driver to raise that themselves, since the state doesn't have the ability to get in their phone without their permission.
You're also allowed to be on a phone call or text at a stoplight. So there's like all these crazy exceptions.
Instead of it being hands-free, it's like hands-free light. And some of these exemptions were put in at the request of Bill Seitz, a longtime state lawmaker, Republican from Cincinnati. And there's been kind of like a consistent pushback by legislators about, too much oversight by police and too many opportunities for cops to stop drivers. And so this was sort of the compromise. No matter how you slice it, distracted driving is absolutely life-changing. It causes
terrible
injuries, disability, death.
Yeah.
All for the sake of, checking your Facebook while you're driving down the highway at
75 miles an hour. I've seen people, watching movies in their cars, which, baffle me.
Yeah, people should not do that.
Yeah.
I'm going out on a limb here.
I once saw somebody driving down the highway shaving, which was the most bananas thing I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, distracted driving comes in all kinds of, it's not just messing around with your phone, but, if you have, your puppy sitting on your lap licking your face while you're driving and eating a hamburger, all of that is distracted
That's
driving.
That's a very specific tableau.
Yeah.
I went on a ride along with the patrol, and the officer, the trooper, cited a woman because she had three dogs on her lap, jumping from the front to
the back.
And it wasn't texting while driving, but it was still distracted driving.
So essentially, this sounds like it just boils down to the cell phone law in Ohio has a bunch of exemptions, and officers don't know why you're touching your phone. They're taking a guess that it could be to send a text, and it's going to be up to you to prove that you weren't going forward.
Yeah, and I don't know how you do that.
It's hard. It's very hard to do that.
I would assume you'd have to get your records, right, and show, hey, at the time you issued this ticket, I don't have any sent text messages.
Yeah. And of course, or you could just pay the ticket instead of hiring a forensic expert to figure out your swipe history of your phone for the last 3 months.
So I've been talking to people in Cleveland and Cincinnati just about this idea in general, and people are saying this is going to impact marginalized communities who are already facing over policing the most, because it's very difficult to prove or to disprove a negative. So when it comes to this, court costs. That costs money. Getting to court, having a court date, paying a ticket. Paying a ticket could be the difference between rent for some people. So I think that obviously there's going to be some issues with this. But, who knows? Who knows what will happen?
Ohio's ordered a mental health treatment center for troubled youth to stop accepting new teens until its problems are fixed. Laura, you wrote about the Youth Intensive Services Center in Youngstown. What did investigators find that was so troubling that they were like, do not take any more children?
Well, this kind of has a longer backstory. The Disability Rights Ohio, which is a nonprofit organization that has the authority to investigate and advocate for disabled folks who are in various settings, including jails, prisons, youth prisons, youth centers. They had heard some complaints, and they started investigating using their right to access. And over the course of 16 months, they kept kind of waving their arms to the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, there's problems here. There's big problems here. These kids are being improperly restrained. The staff is not properly trained. Kids are leaving campus and being out all night, and there's all these police reports, et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't feel like the state agency was really taking taking note of this, and so they publicly released a pretty scathing report in May. And then subsequent to that, the State Department said, like, oh, you know, we'll look into it, or something kind of mild. And they went and did their own survey in early June and found, yeah, there are problems. There were
serious problems.
Yeah, like, you know, people were working without having background checks or,
oh my goodness,
or basic training like CPR. They had one instance in which a kid was in a power struggle with a staffer and got shoved. Another child was held in restraints for an hour and 25 minutes. So the state Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services said, no more new admissions. You guys got to fix all these problems and send us a corrective plan. They could ultimately revoke the license.
Mm.
Youth Intensive Services says that these are kind of documentary issues and that they're going to fix it. And you know.
So we'll have to wait and see.
Right.
And because we can't do an hour of the roundtable without talking about House Bill 6, let's talk about Matt Borges. He is appealing his criminal conviction. The former Ohio Republican Party chair is serving 5 years in federal prison. In case anybody's forgotten, he was arrested with five other men back in 2020 for accepting and giving bribes to pass a $1 billion bailout for two nuclear power plants owned by First Energy. Borges was convicted of bribing a political operative, and now he is in prison and trying to appeal that conviction. So, Morgan, what is in Borges's appeal?
Basically, what he and his attorneys are arguing are the opposite of what his, like, leniency for sentencing document said. He's basically saying, I did not have a bully pulpit. I was not a public official. I did not have the means to pressure people. I was a private actor. I did nothing wrong. And, I mean, that goes back on what his team said back when he was trying to get a lower sentence. And so he's basically saying, I didn't do anything wrong. I shouldn't have been put in this situation with Householder. I'm not at the same level. This was simply political lobbying, not criminal activity.
And arguably, he's not at the same level as the Ohio Speaker of the House. Larry Householder was at the time. But Householder got 20 years, so he had a much bigger, longer sentence.
Yeah.
During the trial, Matt Borges, his defense was kind of like, you know, hey, I don't even go here. You know, like he was brought into this scheme in the final stage, really, and that he...
It was after the bill had passed, become law.
Right, and he was hired to work on the counter campaign to make sure that it didn't make the ballot. And, you know, his defense also was like, you know, Larry Householder and I, we didn't even like each other. Like, we weren't co-conspirators.
They weren't friends.
We weren't friends. We weren't working on this big, you know, scheme. And kind of like, I didn't even know this was happening, was sort of his defense. You know, at sentencing, he stood up in front of Judge Black and said, hey, it was my actions that brought me here, and I recognize that. He got 5 years. He's at the federal facility in Milan, Michigan right now.
So we'll have to see what happens in terms of that appeal. And I should say that former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder also maintains his innocence. He is also appealing his criminal conviction. Let's talk about STRS. We did a whole hour recently with Laura Bischoff on the mess at STRS. The pension fund for Ohio's teachers has been divided for more than a year now about how best to invest its $90 billion. There have been lawsuits and investigations, removals, a whole lot of accusations. So, Morgan, you wrote about the latest twist, the resignation of board member Steve Foreman. Why is he leaving early?
So Steve Foreman is actually, he's leaving early because he is deciding to take retirement. So it's not a non-controversial reason why he's leaving. He decided that in November, he has hit his 34-year marks in public education and is just going to head out. And he wants, you know, there's typically not meetings in the summer, but because of the whole controversy that's going on right now, they're having more meetings. And he wants somebody to get their feet wet and know what's going on prior to, you know.
Now, is he appointed or elected?
He was elected. So his term was from 2022 to 2026. So whoever is going to get appointed to a seat, that will be until August of 2026. When it comes to him, he did tell me, though, that he was concerned about what was going on with the controversy around the, as Attorney General Dave Yost calls it, illegitimate investment firm. And he was worried about where the money was potentially going to go, but that did not play a role in his resignation.
And Laura, does that mean that Governor Mike DeWine gets to appoint his replacement, or how does that work?
I'm not really sure who appoints the elected, a replacement for an elected.
Because he appoints other members of the
board. Right.
It's
an 11-member board. There's four appointees, two retirees who are elected by the membership, and then five teachers, active teachers, who are elected. I'm not sure what the mechanism, Morgan, do you know?
Yeah. So the way that his seat will be fixed is people will bring up names during executive session or during public session, and they will take applications. They will take suggestions.
Oh, it's like
and
a house
the
seat.
Board. Exactly. And then the board gets to decide.
Oh, my goodness. So,
I know.
So while his resignation isn't controversial in the sense that he's just retiring, this replacement fight very much could be.
Only for a couple months, though, because there will be a supermajority once Dale Price's seat, who was a status quo person. He resigned after he was ousted as the chair. So he has an open seat, and Steve Foreman's seat is now going to be open. That's a reformer in a status quo. If a reformer fills a reformer seat, then there's really no controversy.
Well, we will have to wait and see, and we're still waiting to see what finally shakes out with how they invest that $90 billion, because that's not settled yet either, Laura.
No. I think there's a chance that they'll have a special meeting in July. They haven't noticed the meeting yet, but I think that they're going to talk about the performance bonus plan, which is for about 65 STRS investment professionals. There's a lot of there's some opposition to that. Particularly from retirees who are kind of like, look, we haven't gotten a COLA in a long time, and these people are making all this money, and teachers don't make that kind of money. And so there's a lot of complaining about that. I think the STRS management says, look, if we want to have top-tier investment managers, we need to have performance bonuses, et cetera. So there's that hanging out there. The executive director is still on paid leave, was put on paid leave in November, after an anonymous letter surfaced accusing him of being a bad guy. And the investigation found that those were unsubstantiated charges, but the board decided to keep him on leave. So there's all that happening.
So it is a mess.
There's a whole bunch of issues kind of swirling around. And then there's this Dave Yost trying to remove the chair and Wade Steen from the board.
You know, when I've talked with a lot of educators who are looking at this situation, I mean, people are very divided about this, but there is a circumstance, legal professors have said, you know, it might not be, STRS might not be doing a good job, but the other option isn't good either. So this is all at the expense of the educators.
Yeah, and ultimately, this is their retirement money. This is the money they plan to live on once they're no longer working.
Yeah, and I also add that Ohio is not a Social Security state for public employees, so the public pension funds are their main pension.
We're going to talk about something that we don't usually talk about here on the Reporter Roundtable, the Columbus Zoo. With his trial date looming, the former marketing director of the Columbus Zoo pled guilty to 16 felony counts last week. Pete Fingerhut, along with other executives, were accused of misusing millions of dollars in zoo funds over the course of a decade. An investigation claimed they spent this money attending sport events, repeatedly taking alcohol and beer from the zoo's warehouse for personal parties, and gave out no bid contracts for construction. They even let family members live in zoo-owned properties at discounted rates. Fingerhut faces up to 37 years in prison, and he's agreed to pay more than $600,000 in restitution. Laura, this, like, you don't think of zoos as a place of public corruption scandals.
Right. And I think the former chief executive, Tom Stauff, is set to go on trial August 6th.
Yeah, it's coming
up. I think that Fingerhut's guilty plea probably comes, you know, oftentimes guilty pleas come with an agreement to cooperate.
To testify.
And so that's probably, you know, not good for the defendant.
The House Bill 6 case, right? Three of the guys pled. Two of them pled.
Juan and Jeff.
Yeah, and they got reduced sentences as a result of their cooperation.
Well, they haven't been sentenced yet.
Oh, that's right.
The prosecutors agreed to recommend pretty light sentences in those cases.
0 to 6 months.
Yeah, so in Fingerhut's case, we don't yet know if he's cut a deal with prosecution, but safe to say it is possible given that the executive, the guy above him, essentially, is set to go on trial.
Yeah, and this was a case that was investigated by the state auditor's office. I think it came on the heels of some good reporting from the Columbus Dispatch.
Yeah, Fingerhut's trial was scheduled to start tomorrow. So we will wait and see whether he ends up testifying later on next month. Coming up, what Ohio Democrats are saying about whether President Joe Biden should stay on the ballot. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us are Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, and Morgan Trow, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Earlier this hour, we talked about whether any minor party candidates would make the ballot this November. Now I want to talk about whether President Joe Biden is going to be on our ballot. Two Ohio Democrats want him to step down, former U.S. Representative Tim Ryan and former Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley. And it's not just because they don't think he can win the presidency. Andrew, why do they think it's going to hurt Senator Sherrod Brown's reelection?
For anybody who follows politics, but the president race is very important. And even if people don't necessarily expect Democrats to win Ohio based on what's happened in recent elections here, still people turn out to vote for their person. And if there is the concern that these two guys raised, Tim Ryan and John Cranley, is that if, if Democrats are not feeling Joe Biden based on what they saw in the debate recently, in which he struggled to sort of answer questions in a coherent manner, then they're not going to show up just to vote at all. And that whether it's, the base that might not be excited may not vote, whether it's swing voters who maybe don't love Donald Trump but also don't want to vote for Joe Biden, maybe they wouldn't then also show up and vote for Sherrod Brown. So it's something that...
Fear of staying home, essentially.
Yeah. And it would, just when you're talking about somebody like Sherrod Brown who has been in office for a long time, if he does win, the general belief is that it will be a very close race. Everything makes a difference, whether it's, and then not to speak of Democrats running for the state legislature, trying to undo the veto-proof supermajority that Republicans hold, whether it's the two incumbent Democratic Ohio Supreme Court justices, it just has the potential for ramifications that will fall all the way down the ballot.
Yeah. Ryan wants Vice President Kamala Harris to be at the top of the ticket. Here's what he said in a Newsweek opinion column published last week. Ryan wrote, "I was the first presidential candidate to endorse Joe Biden in 2020. I love America. I love our party. I love Joe Biden. The Democratic nominee in 2024 should be Kamala Harris." So he's pretty point blank about it. Now, I will say neither Ryan nor Cranley currently hold public office. Our current office holders have been quiet on this issue. Morgan, I haven't heard anything really from Senator Brown other than it's Biden's decision.
Yeah, he actually spoke to my station I believe, last week, and he said, you know, I'm focused on my race. I'm not a political pundit. You know, I'm doing me. That's a different race. That's a different election. Like, Ohioans know who I am. They know my beliefs. So I think that he's trying to be quiet. I don't know. I've heard different things from different politicians if this could hurt or help him. You know, I remember when all of this Biden debacle was going on with our ballot, and people were saying, well, if Biden's not on the ballot, then maybe Republicans won't show up to vote because they care about Donald Trump. And if there's no competitor, then why would we go? But these are all theoreticals. I mean, there's going to be somebody on the ballot. Honestly, at this point, it would probably likely be Biden. So who knows? But I totally agree with Andrew with the fact that Sherrod Brown's race is going to be very close. And it's, I mean, very important to the Senate majority in Congress. But I think the statewide races also, of course, matter a lot. And I think that there is merit to what the Democrats are saying.
Yeah, I think that Brown and the two Democrats, Mike Donnelly and Melody Stewart on the Ohio Supreme Court, could use the coattails of a strong top of the ticket. I don't know that Biden is going to be that strong top of the ticket. I also think that even if the president were to step aside and say, okay, I'm gonna not run, it's not going to just go to Kamala Harris as a given. There's a long line of contenders, governors, etc., who would love to step in and, you know, be the nominee without having to go through the rigors of a national campaign. So,
yeah. For instance, John Cranley, the former Cincinnati mayor who ran for governor and lost in 2022, mentioned a few local people that he likes. He mentioned Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. He mentioned Pete Buttigieg, who's now a federal official running the Department of Transportation, but he used to be the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And he also mentioned Andy Beshear, who's the governor of Kentucky. And so you can imagine,
Democrat who won in Kentucky, you can see the appeal.
Yeah. But in his tweet that he posted after watching the debate and presumably was upset, he also floated the governor of Colorado. So like Laura mentioned, there's just any number of people that could potentially come out of the woodwork if we end up actually having, you know, an open nomination for the Democratic Party.
That convention would be like just a total, it's going to be wild if that were to happen.
Ohio's other senator, J.D. Vance, has weighed in on this whole debate. He posted on X that, quote, if he, referring to President Biden, if he's unfit to run for president, he certainly isn't fit to be president. If he doesn't run again, he needs to resign as commander-in-chief. So Vance obviously has taken a stake on this, but still no word yet on whether J.D. is going to be Trump's VP, right? I mean, we're getting down to the wire here.
I was off for the holiday last week, and so I got a text this morning from a Republican source, and I was like, do I want to answer this? Like, I was trying to get ready. I'm like, I should, because it might be that Donald Trump announced his vice presidential candidate pick. The RNC starts next Monday. We're going to know before then. And so I don't, the question is when. And knowing Donald Trump, he's been known to just tweet something at 1 a.m. on Friday and it be major news, like, I'm going to endorse so-and-so and so-and-so race and help them win the nomination.
I got to think this will be a campaign event.
You would think. I wouldn't assume anything.
Trump never does anything that you would expect,
yeah,
honestly.
That's fair. I don't know.
But yeah, it is. I think, there's some talk ahead of the presidential debate that Trump might try to make news by announcing who his running mate was going to be. He's clearly kind of allowed this whole Biden question to kind of play out for a while.
And I think it was smart of him not to say anything to, like, Republicans generally are keeping their big mouths shut on this question.
Yeah, I mean, Trump's been really going at it on Truth Social, but, notably he hasn't held any public events. He's sort of just, it's kind of more of the same from him. So he is letting Democrats kind of do their thing and let the storyline play out.
Yeah, it's conventional political wisdom that when your opponent is flailing, you just kind of let him twist in the wind.
Yeah, but we'll see. I mean, it'll obviously be a very different convention if us in the Ohio media and for Ohio voters if there are Republican Senate seats on the line, because whether or not you like J.D. Vance, everybody will have a stake in it, because if he were to win, then suddenly we have an open Senate seat here, and that's going to be a big thing that we're going to be hearing about for the next year or two.
Governor Mike DeWine will get to appoint a temporary replacement, and then in addition to potentially minimum wage in 2025, we would have a Senate race in 2025, and I think I'm exhausted already thinking about it.
It would be in 2026, actually, so you'd be able to stagger it. It's the next regularly held election is what the law says.
Okay.
So, but still, yeah.
I thought it was 2025. Never mind. So we'd have elections in 23, 24, 25 if we did minimum wage, and then 26 for, oh my goodness.
Yep.
It never stops.
Politics, man.
We never get a year off. There is no off year anymore.
At least not in Ohio.
No. Actually, I want to get a quick update, Morgan, on marijuana. So how many dispensaries have been approved to sell recreational marijuana, and are any of them open yet?
So there have been 110 different dispensaries that are already licensed to sell medical marijuana that have received provisional licenses to become a dual facility. So what this means is that they'll be able to sell both. Right now, provisional means that they're going through the process. Those will likely be the first ones that open. Right now, the Cannabis Coalition in Ohio, they're saying that it could be between the next 2 weeks that these stores are going to be able to sell. We don't know, though. I mean, there's a back and forth. So what you need to do from a provisional to a license of like a certificate to be able to fully operate, you have to go through a slew of different tests. You have to do test sales. You have to meet with the cannabis division in the state. You have to demonstrate that you keep logs. You have to demonstrate that you have security. There's a bunch of different things. It's mainly just procedural. And all of these dispensaries right now, they're already licensed for medical. So it likely won't be a challenge for them to do all this because a lot of these things they've already done.
So it's just a lot of ticking boxes.
Exactly. It's the ticking boxes. So hopefully for consumers, 2, 3, 4 weeks.
Which is ahead of the fall deadline they were originally shooting for. So looking like still while it's summer.
Yeah. So yes, it is a slight delay from what the Department of Commerce and what policymakers were telling us that it would be mid-June. But it is before that September 7th deadline that is in the state law.
And speaking of state law, Ohio legalized shooting off 4th of July fireworks 2 years ago. And so far, that decision has generated $3 million extra dollars in taxes that is going to firefighter training. So, I mean, we could always buy them. But we had to like sign something saying, oh, I swear I'm taking them
sure.
out of state.
They called it the liar's law for a reason. You had to, you know, sign an affidavit promising you're going to take them to a state in which it was legal to set them off. And
so it seems like more people are buying them now that it's like maybe people who did follow the law before. I mean, $3 million extra dollars for firefighter training isn't chump change.
I'm sure they need it.
Yeah. I should be noted that they said that it doesn't go to prevention of firework fires. It goes to all kinds of firefighter training. And that last year we had 128 fires caused by setting off fireworks. So be careful out there.
Actually, it was 128 fireworks cause incidences, which I'm not sure what that is. Maybe it could have been injuries or whatever, but 22 of those resulted in residential building fires that cost like almost $700,000 in property damage. That's according to the state fire marshals. I was trying to figure out if like since we liberalized the use of consumer fireworks, if we saw like a big giant increase in.
You want to see what like happens in emergency rooms? Like how many people come in with hand injuries?
Oh, I mean, a friend of mine's a hand surgeon, and it's like everybody has to work that weekend.
That's unsettling.
The number of fireworks related fires has increased, I think we need more data to determine if it's because the law has been loosened up.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I will say that in my own neighborhood, the last week, it's been nothing but fireworks every single night.
Right, and you know, this new law allows people to use consumer fireworks on like New Year's Day, Chinese New Year, Cinco de Mayo, Memorial Day weekend, Juneteenth. Your next legal window is Labor Day weekend. So
stop shooting them off now. Save them for Labor Day.
Yeah. I mean, I was at a friend's house and her dog was just freaking out because the fireworks were really driving.
Yeah, my parents' dog, when I visited them, was actually calm, but it's just because he's so traumatized from people shooting off fireworks all week. So, yeah.
Do they live on the lake?
I'm sorry, what?
I said, do they live on a lake? Is that like...
No, but they live in Parma, so it's like, you know, the people love fireworks there.
I mean, there were fireworks last night. I live in Columbus, and yeah. There's constantly fireworks.
Right, it's not the day of July 4th, it's the week of July 4th that people set them off. Even though the law says just on July 4th.
Does it even make it special anymore?
It happens all the time.
That was Morgan Trow, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau.
Thank you very much.
And last but certainly not least, Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com.
Great to be here.
I also want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, including producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, intern producers Abigail Jump and Kira Kaidar, and our board operator today, Cameron Howard. Thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.